This is the weekend edition of the Daily Gold Podcast, covering precious metals and global capital markets for intelligent investors. Now, here is your host, Jordan Roy Byrne.
Hello again, everyone. Thank you for joining me today on the Daily Gold Podcast. And on this episode, we're chatting with returning guest Dan Norsini. You can find his work at traderdan.com. Dan, thanks for coming on today. How are you?
Hey, Jordan, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure to talk with you in the past, and I'm looking forward to talking with you again today.
Yeah, Dan, there's so much to talk about in the markets, and honestly, I don't know where to start because we covered so much before we came on, but let's talk about the first post you have on your website. GLD Holdings hit 32-month high. I know that you have been really one of the leaders in terms of analysts who've been focusing on GLD. I mean, we've done interviews in the past where you've talked about it. And, I mean, not to bring up the commitment of traders, but, I mean, that has been leaning bearish for the last couple months, yet GLD has continued to add more and more gold, even as gold has gone sideways over the last couple months. Is your take that the GLD, I mean, is that the, obviously there's many factors we could look at with gold, but is that a kind of a powerful leading indicator with respect to gold's near-term trend? I mean, give us your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I still think it is, Jordan. And matter of fact, it's interesting that you brought those, you know, commitment of traders reports up, because when we were looking at some of those not that long ago, you know, we were talking about some pretty hefty imbalances in the gold market, you know, the futures, where you had some very, very heavy long side exposure by the hedge funds against some very heavy short exposure among the commercials and the swap dealers. And, you know, normally, you know, those are, well, let's put it this way, in the past, during the previous bullish phases of gold, when you would get those imbalances, man, you start getting red lights flashing and sirens going off. It was a very cautionary type of situation because you knew how fast that thing could get out of control. If a technical downside level got taken out, you had this massive amount of long side liquidation potential. And, you know, normally, and rightfully so, it made people a little bit circumspect, a little bit cautious about, you know, the future prospects for gold in the near term. But even though that was occurring, it was against a backdrop where you just had inflow after inflow going into GLD. I mean, the thing showed no signs of weakening. You had, you know, it seemed like almost every day or certainly every week you had an increase in reported holdings in there. And no matter what the imbalance was like over in the futures market, the reported holdings kept climbing and climbing and climbing. And it was one of those deals where you had that also being accompanied by very strong performance in the gold mining sector. And it was like that was overriding any concern that people would have normally had in a futures market. You know, lo and behold, when we did get somewhat of a correction lower, we did get some liquidation, we did get some selling, but because the GLD never really broke down, you never see a sharp exodus of money flows out of that ETF. You didn't see a drastic reduction in the reported gold holdings. You know, the sell-off in gold is at the COMEX, you know, in the futures market was relatively shallow. I mean, it didn't go down that far compared to what it could have with that amount of long-side exposure. So in my mind, as long as those GLD holdings, do they continue to rise or stay firm, I just don't see much downside in the gold market, because really what the GLD is telling you is that Western-based investment demand is rock solid. And, you know, for whatever reason, and you and I can talk about that as we get further into the interview here, but for whatever that reason, people want to own gold here in the West now. You know, there's a lot of uncertainty out there, and they feel comfortable buying it. And when those inflows go in, it really makes it hard for the bears at the COMEX to press that market down. You simply got too much demand coming in. And that, to me, that's a very, very key indicator. As long as it holds up, hey, I think dips in the gold price will be bought. And I think retracements are going to be shallow. You'd have to see something that would change what's going on with gold, where you'd have all of a sudden a big exodus out there for me to feel concerned about a sharp sell-off in the gold market. I just don't see it coming as long as GLD holds firm.
Yeah, and just to follow up on that, you said something that I want to reiterate for our listeners, because I know that you and I really both believe this, that I mean, there's so many, you know, pseudo gold or pseudo gold analysts out there and pundits, and it just seemed like during the bear market, every week, every month, oh, there's strong demand for gold, strong demand, you know, record coin sales, etc. But I think you agree with me that as far as gold demand, this is really the key thing to watch. I mean, do you agree with me on that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely, Jordan. Could not agree with you more. I mean, that is a key barometer. And you know, gold demand for coins, I mean, that's fine. That's good. It's good that it stays strong. Okay. But, I mean, that's from mainly, let's call it, and not to denigrate any of these people, that's from the smaller buyers. That's from, folks buying coins for their retirement or for wealth preservation or for whatever reason they want to hold gold. And I mean, that's completely understandable. It's legitimate, but I'm talking about big moneyed interests, big players, big investment firms, money managers that have a lot of capital to put to work. That's what I'm talking about. I mean, they're not so much buying, the physical coins. They simply buy stuff that's for them a little bit more liquid. And when they got GLD in front of them, they can move in and out of that easily, with a click of a button. That's the kind of thing they like to get into. And when that big money from those outfits goes into GLD, that's your real source of Western demand. And that to me is what really is, that's the driver for a higher gold price. I mean, you get that demand coming out of Asia. You get that demand coming out of India. I mean, that's something anybody who's been around the gold market for years understands. That's sort of a given. It's going to be there. It's going to fluctuate a lot with the price. Those guys are a lot more price sensitive. They don't like necessarily chase prices higher. They're more value-based buyers. But they always provide a pretty good floor of support underneath the metal during dips. They're there. They're buying it. You got a lot of the, think about it. You got 1 billion people in China. You got 1 billion people in India. That's a lot of gold buying. And so that tends to kind of give you that physical market support. But the Western-based demand, if you don't have that, you're not going to get these strong moves higher in gold. And, that had been missing for most of 2015. Well, heck, it's been missing during the phase in which gold was in a bear market. But as you see that come back, you see that Western-based demand come back in, you see the response in the gold price. And it's obviously right now, gold is very strong on the charts. I mean, it simply doesn't want to break down. And we've obviously had the change in the Fed, the dovish posture of the Fed to contribute a lot of that. But the fact is, there's still a lot of uncertainty out there around the globe. And that's why that money keeps flowing into GLD.
Yeah, and let's talk about, speaking of GLD and the huge money that's been going into it. I mean, Stan Druckenmiller last year really loaded up on it. And I think Mr. Moneybags or Master of the Universe, George Soros. I mean, he's been going into it. How much, because you've been a real professional trader for a long time. I mean, give us the psyche. I mean, how much does that really matter if some big name like that goes into gold? I mean, obviously fundamentals and technicals really drive the market. But I mean, does that have any psychological impact if some big whale like that, goes into the market and then there's news about it?
Yeah, it still does, Jordan. I mean, even in this day of computers, it still does. And, it's one of those deals where like Warren Buffett goes in and he's going to buy a bunch of railroad stock in this company or whatever he's going to buy. And news gets out from one of the reported holdings that he acquired a big position there. There's still people that want to piggyback on that. And simply being because these guys have got pretty good track records, and so they come in, they piggyback. But the other thing what happens is whenever you get big buys in anything, when you get somebody come in and in size, it shows up on these technical price charts, and some people maybe oftentimes poo-poo the technical indicators, but we gotta admit, I mean, we're in a world where computers are doing the bulk of the trading nowadays. And whenever these, a big player comes in, they leave a footprint, and that footprint shows up on those price charts. And those computers notice those things, and they start coming in because they're programmed to do that, quite honestly. Well, once you get that kind of buyer coming in and you get that footprint, you start tripping these computers. They start moving into a buy mode, and then that feeds on itself. They buy it, enough more of them come in, they push the price a little higher, more computers come in. So you basically shift these computers away from their selling posture into a buying posture. And then all of a sudden you got this momentum that builds in the market. And that's what drives these, our Western markets today. That's what drives them. You've got to have that momentum based buying in there. You know, it used to be the old adage was, well, you buy low and you sell high. Well, the value-based guys still do that. They, you know, that's the guys like Soros. That's the guys like Buffett. You know, those are guys that look around. They have a big macro view, and they come in and make these long-term acquisitions, and they come in size. But the majority of hedge funds aren't like that. You know, they're basically running algorithms. Those algorithms, they don't buy low and sell high. They buy high and just keep buying higher. They'll just keep buying until they get a signal to tell them to stop buying and then to sell, and then they'll reverse. So once a guy comes in like a Soros and they leave the footprints, then the computers start firing up. So, it does make a difference. I mean, it puts that floor underneath the market that flips the computers to the buy side, and that's what gets the ball rolling to the upside.
Great info on that, Dan. Now let's move from gold. I want to talk about silver. I just pulled up a chart here as you were talking. I mean, just looking at silver, the weekly candle chart, I really like the way that's set up. I really like the action. It's kind of been a slow rise. I mean, it retraced a good amount of the rebound this year. Bullish hammer a couple weeks ago, and this past week was up 5.4%, closing at the high of the week. You know, we did not chat about silver before we got on the air here. Give me your thoughts on silver here.
You know, it's kind of interesting watching this metal, and I've got some sort of mixed feelings about silver. I mean, I can't argue with its performance, and I don't mean mixed in a way where I'm poo-pooing the move higher. I guess where I'm coming from with silver is you never really know if silver is going to be a precious metal or an industrial metal, the way it trades. You know, and Jordan, what we did, you know, last year, 2015, you know, we had, well, even going back into 2014, you know, when we were struggling with the slow growth phenomenon, you know, where you had the deflation pressures building, you had copper moving lower, you had platinum moving lower, you know, palladium was moving lower, aluminum was moving lower, you know, iron ore, all these base metals, these industrial metals were moving lower, you know, as the deflationary mindset was in play. Well, of course, silver then was trading along, right along with them. It was in a deflationary psyche. It was moving lower and, you know, could have ground its way down there. You know, it moved down from, I don't know, $24 or whatever it was in 2014 down to around $13, $14 last year before it finally bottomed out. Okay, so it turns around and it starts to move higher here. And the interesting thing about that is, where it, in the past, it was sort of tracking with copper. You know, as copper moved lower over the slow growth fears, so too was silver. It was going down along copper. Now we have the situation, and this is what I was trying to say when I first started off talking about it. Now we have the situation where copper is continuing to break down on its chart, but silver has divorced itself from moving with copper. Now it's moving in the direction with gold. So it's almost like silver's had sort of a personality shift. It's moved away from an industrial metal, at least for the time being, and it's moving like a precious metal. It's actually firm. It seems to be the last couple of days in particular was ignoring completely what was going on in the dollar, which was really interesting because, you know, if you think back to last Friday, you know, we're doing this report here a Friday, a week after the payrolls report number came out. We had that horrific payrolls number that we got for May. And of course, that just slammed the dollar lower. Well, silver, you know, flipped the inverse of the dollar. Dollar goes down. I mean, gold went flying. Silver went flying. That's kind of be expected. You know, you've seen that macro trade when the dollar goes down, you get commodities generally get bought. And of course, silver and gold had big, big days there on that payroll number. But okay, so here, the last couple of days of this week, we see the dollar actually firmed up. I mean, we had, you know, the dollar went down there by, I think on the USDX was down below 93.40, something like that. And it popped higher the last 2 days. Well, silver just ignored it. It just went right up alongside of the dollar rising, just like gold did. And so you could see where something else is at play here, Jordan, you know, than we've had in the past. There's a little bit different price action going on. I don't know how long that's going to last, but to me, it's noteworthy in the fact that it's not moving lower. Silver, that is, it's not moving lower, even as the dollar strengthens, is something you got to pay attention to because it hasn't happened all that often that we're seeing it now. So, you know, it looks good on the charts. You know, I might as well bring it up while we're talking about it. I mean, it's had a good move off of this support level down around $16. I was watching that level very closely. And basically because I saw copper breaking down. So I thought, well, silver's going back down. Copper's going back down. All right, are we going to break below $16 on silver? And are we going to start falling back into this box on the chart? You know, we going down to $15.50, $15. You know, what's going to happen to silver along with these other base metals? Well, when it hit $16, unlike copper, it reversed. and it just popped higher and has been going since. I mean, like the last 5 days or whatever it was, it's moved from around $16, we're up around $17.30, $17.40. That's a pretty good move in 5 days. And again, that was in spite of what the dollar was doing the last 2 days. So now I think we're at a point with silver where we're kind of getting to a crossroads up here. It's close to $17.50. And the reason I bring that up is because if you look at a chart on a daily chart, silver only had one close above $17.50 since really almost the beginning of May. So we're talking about, let's call it five, maybe 5.5 weeks, where you only had one close in this metal above $17.50. So you've had some price spikes up there. You had price spike up to $17.60, $17.65, but it would always sell off. And then it finally fell down below $17 and it went all the way to $16. So I'm watching this thing, Jordan. I want to see how this is going to act. If it gets back up to $17.50, I would dearly love for it to go up there because I want to see what it's going to do when it gets in that area. And for me, even if copper is breaking down, even if it continues to move lower, which it did break down on its charts this week, copper did, if silver gets above $17.50, and to me, if it can close above there, particularly if it can close above it twice, and particularly if copper's going the other way, then I think you have to make the case that silver is now trading as a precious metal and has divorced itself from the industrial metals, which would be very that would be a significant development if you ask me. And I don't know whether it's going to do that, but that's why I'm watching the charts to see how it's going to act if it gets up in that area.
Yeah. Before we get to copper, because I do want to talk about that, you touched on it. Do you generally think that the strength in the miners is basically telling us that gold and silver are likely to probably move higher? I mean, I know we're just thinking ahead here, but I mean, I personally share that view. Do you also share that view, or are you a little more cautious?
Well, it's hard to argue with that chart. I mean, that's for sure. You look at the chart of these miners. I mean, it's phenomenal. It's impressively phenomenal in this sense. I mean, they simply won't break down. That's the thing that amazes me is that you had, you know, at the COMEX, this is what was so interesting. You know, when we had that period of weakness that we had in gold not all that long ago, you know, this was back when we were talking rate hike in June. And, you know, remember, I guess it was before the Fed changed their tone. All of a sudden, it seemed like they had all these Fed governors coming out, including yelling, you know, they're all talking hawkishly. And then, you know, then we had that one piece of data. I remember it was a new home sales data. And that, man, that was a stunner. It was just very, very strong. Matter of fact, that day, copper shot up and went flying higher that day. And you actually saw some real pressure coming into some of these metals, these precious metals, because the dollar had a big day. It was all this was like food for the Fed to go, oh yeah, they're going to hike the sale. This new home sales number is strong. Then we got, I think it was the consumer spending number the next day, if I remember correctly, that was strong. So it was all like, everything was kind of coming into place where, yeah, they're going to hike. They're going to go in June. They're going to go. And then all of a sudden we started getting a little bit of weaker data. And then of course we got the payrolls number and everything completely fell apart. And then, of course, copper imploded. And you had some bad news coming out of China as well, weak news. And then, of course, the dollar initially fell apart, too, on that. So going back to your question with these miners, even though we had weakness in the metal, gold, they really didn't break down. They wouldn't go down to HUI is what I like to look at a lot because it's got a lot of the big caps in it. And a lot of more speculative are in the juniors. But anyhow, the big caps, the large caps, that thing would not go down below 200 on the HUI. And it almost seemed like it didn't care what gold was doing at the COMEX. It wouldn't break down. And so obviously there were some big buyers, very large buying taking place in there. And when you have buying like that, again, as we mentioned earlier, it leaves a footprint on that chart. I mean, you can see where those support levels form. You can see where those buyers are coming in. And the fact that they would not break lower and that ratio wouldn't break down, that HUI to gold ratio kept drifting higher. I mean, and you know, Jordan, one thing we can say that's been pretty consistent, you know, since we've been following gold for a long time is that HUI to gold ratio is a pretty good economic indicator when it comes to gold prices. I mean, with that ratio is rising, it's very rare that you see gold completely falling apart. If that ratio is declining, it's falling off, it's very rare that you're going to see rallies in gold last for long. Well, when you have the HUI to gold ratio continuing to stay firm and then actually moving higher into fresh highs, the gold price simply wouldn't break down. So those gold shares were, yeah, they were telling you something that obviously there was some big buying in the gold shares. That kind of support, when you see that, it makes the bears nervous, you know, at the COMEX. They see it because they've used that indicator for years themselves. I mean, they look at that. And if, you know, if they're trading gold at the futures and they look over at, you know, at the, some of the quotes and they're looking at some of these leading, whether it's a Newmont or a Barrick or just the indexes with the HUI or the AUX, XAU, and they're looking at that stuff and it's falling apart. I guarantee you they're going to get aggressive. I mean, they're going to get bold in their offers. They're going to try to push that price down. They're going to try to go stop hunting below the market. But when on the other hand, they turn around, and they look at those indices being firm and those gold shares being firm, they get nervous. And they're not going to risk it, so they're going to cover. They're not going to be able to press the market down. So when those gold shares stay firm, it's very, very hard to break the price of the metals down. So, again, when you have guys like Soros coming in there and he bought that huge position in Barrick Gold, and you have other guys coming in and piggyback on it, then you have those momentum funds coming in, those other hedge funds rolling along with it. You've got a lot of buying in that sector. And as long as those shares stay strong, yeah, I mean, you're – and particularly if that ratio is rising, if that HUI continues to outpace gold and that ratio continues to move higher, then at some point the metal has to catch up with the shares, and generally that's when you'll see it pop higher.
Right. And we even saw a little bit of that today with I think the metals were up, but the shares had a little bit of a bearish reversal.
Right.
But, I mean, they've had, what, like a 20% – I mean, in the case of GDXJ, I think it was like a 25% move from the low 2 weeks ago to the high yesterday or today. I mean, they're due for some cooling off.
Absolutely. I mean, the HUI was at 200, you know, to start off the month of June. You know, it was at over 240 yesterday. I mean, that's nothing to sneeze at. That's one heck of a move in what? I mean, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, about seven trading sessions. Man, that's pretty doggone good money. So yeah, it's not surprising to see some profit taking in there. Not at all. You're ahead of the weekend, that's for sure.
And I think you talked a lot about copper. I guess my question with that would be, we've seen so many commodities recover. I mean, I haven't looked at everything individually. I've noticed the softs or the ags are starting to recover strongly. And of course, we already talked about precious metals. Oil had a big rebound. I mean, with respect to copper, why isn't copper following, and do you think at some point copper will turn around, or might it not be until the next economic expansion begins?
Man, that's a really good question. That's been one of the main questions I've had as I've been watching what's going on in the commodity sector in general, and looking, you know, basically like you said, you watch crude oil, it doubled in price, went from $26, I guess it was down in mid-February where it made a low, almost made it to 52, you know, just this past week. I mean, you're talking about you doubled it, and then what's that, three and a half months, almost 4 months? You had a huge move in crude oil. Natural gas prices have bottomed out. You watched an explosive move in the soybean market. I mean, soybeans went from near $8 a bushel to almost $12 a bushel. I mean, they're just flying higher. Corn moved higher. You watched, like you're saying, the softs, sugar exploded, coffee exploded. Cotton was firm for a while. So you could pick a lot of these commodities and you could just see these money flows coming into them. And then you turn around and you look at copper and it's going the wrong way. You know, you're scratching your head going, duh, what's going on with copper? Somebody hasn't told it that there's a party going on in the commodity sector. And the way I'm looking at this right now, Jordan, and I can't, there's no way I can confirm this right now, but to me, copper still is one of the most pure indicators I know for sentiment reflecting global growth. It moves higher when you get a general commodity buying psyche that takes hold, but it never really divorces itself from economic growth, underlying economic growth. And when you see it moving lower like this, it simply tells me that even though you may see other commodity markets moving higher, some of those markets may be moving more on individual fundamentals. You know, we're kind of used to watching this commodity asset class move in sort of in a general direction. They all tend to move higher. They all tend to move lower. We've seen that over the past, you know, how many years, particularly when, you know, everything started in 2008, we had the big crash. everything went down. All the commodities went down together. Well, heck, stocks went down together. Everything was going down, but all the commodities went down together. Didn't matter what the fundamentals might have been. They all sold off. Then when they unleashed quantitative easing, they announced it in the end of 2008. I think they unleashed it in early 2009. Then they all recovered. Then they all started moving higher together. They were moving in unison. You didn't see too many exceptions or standouts. So it was basically a commodity asset trade. It was a macro trade in which, you know, the big funds would come in. If the dollar was going higher, they would sell commodities. If the dollar was going down, they'd buy commodities. Now it looks like you're getting a little bit more specific, where some of them are focusing in on individual fundamentals within these various markets. You know, you mentioned the softs, for instance, like sugar and coffee have been moving for various reasons that are related to the supply side of that equation. You know, sugar looked like it's run into a supply deficit now. We've had some bad weather in India. We've had bad weather in Brazil, particularly when they were trying to load some of that sugar from the sugarcane crush. They were trying to get it out to port. It's still got some antiquated road structures down there, so it's hard for those guys to get their crops out to the ports. So you had loading issues down there, and now all of a sudden they brought in freeze warnings down in Brazil, and that impacts the coffee crop. So what I'm trying to say there is that you actually had specific fundamentals that were driving some of those softs higher. Same thing with the grains. You know, we had a big USDA report today showing the drop in the carryover for the soybean market and the corn market. So, you know, individually you can make the case that some of these commodity markets can now move higher, not as an asset class, but based on their own set of supply and demand fundamentals, whereas copper is doing the same thing, but it's moving on a set of supply and demand fundamentals that are negative, that they're bearish. So it's actually moving lower. I mean, I think it was this past week, if I remember correctly, the LME, the London Metal Exchange, reported one of the very, very large inflow of copper into their warehouses over there. And so what they were noticing that was, when you get those kind of inflows into the warehouse, there's just not a lot of demand for the metal. It's just being inventoried. So in China in particular, I think China does about 43% of the total copper usage around the globe. They're the largest copper consumer. And the Chinese trade data that came out this week was not friendly toward copper. And so you have, you know, concerns about slowing in the biggest user in the world of copper, and you had those warehouse inflows of the metal, and that worked to press it down. I guess I said all that to say this, is that, you know, fundamentally from an economic growth standpoint, you don't see a lot of industrial demand for copper. And so you can see it moving down on the slow growth fears. It's certainly not moving up and taking part in any of these other commodity market rallies, which then brings the other question up. Okay, so why are some of these other commodity markets rallying? Well, obviously we have the fundamentals that are related to it, but I think there's another issue here that, Jordan, that kind of comes into play. And you and I talked a little bit about this before we had the interview here. I think some of this is simply related to the fact that there's negative interest rates are so widespread now around the globe. You know, you've got over in Europe, I mean, just this Friday, the 10-year German bond dropped down to a record low rate, a yield of 0.17%. That's less than 2 basis points for 10 years. I mean, that is mind-boggling to think about tying your money up for 10 years in an investment that pays you 0.2%. I can't even comprehend that rates are so low. Well, you've got ultra low rates in Japan where you've got negative rates. I mean, this week we had news that one of the big primary dealers in Japan, I believe it was Mitsui, one of the big banks, basically said, hey, we don't want to be a primary dealer anymore for Japanese government bonds because we don't want to buy Japanese government bonds because they're paying nothing. They're, matter of fact, it costs us money to buy them. They've got negative rates on them. And for that to happen, that'd be like Goldman Sachs or J.P. Morgan basically telling the Fed, hey, guess what? We don't want to be a primary dealer anymore. We don't want to sit in on the meetings, you know, with some of the big officials here. We don't want to talk about interest rate policy. We're gonna be out of those meetings because we're no longer a primary dealer. I mean, that is a hugely, hugely big, significant, you know, privilege to have something like that. And the fact that rates were so low in Japan, this bank's just saying, hey, we don't even want to do this anymore. So you've got a situation around the globe where I think a lot of people or investors are saying, well, we're in a world that we put our money. We can't make any money in anything. They're worried to death, rightly so, about stocks. I mean, some of these stocks have been so elevated, you know, globally, you're seeing a lot of shakiness in the equity markets. So I think there's also a play now where some of these investors are simply buying commodities. And they're buying them not because of a growth story, not because of a potential that, oh, yeah, we see the economy improving. You know, we think growth prospects are going to improve as we move on out. I think they're buying them because they don't know where else to put their money because they can't make any yield. And they're simply saying, I'm going to buy something tangible and just going to hold it. Some of these prices were so low, I'll buy them down here simply because they're cheap and hopefully they'll go up somewhat. And I think that's some of what you're seeing and explains some of these movements in these commodity markets.
Great points, Dan. On that note, you've covered so much today. But before I let you go, can you tell our listeners where they can go to follow your work and subscribe?
I do. They can come over to www.traderdan.com and they can look at some of this stuff. And you know, we break down these markets over there, Jordan, where we've got, you know, technical analysis on the charts. And as a matter of fact, you know, if you want to briefly just mention gold, if you want to talk about that, you got a minute to talk about this price chart here on this interview or not?
Sure, absolutely. Go ahead.
Okay, well, just looking at the chart, I thought I'd mention it. You know, we've had a really good rebound off the $1,200 level. It's kind of interesting because you had that round number we mentioned, you know, silver bouncing off of $16, and now we're going to see if it can get to $1,750 and close up there. Well, gold did the same thing. It kind of came down to that psychological level at $1,200, you know, really in late May, popped down below there, and basically from there, it's gone down, you know, gone from 1,200 all the way up to 12, you know, near 1,280 today. I mean, a nice $80 run off of there. Now it's up in an area where you had some selling come in previously, and that was right around that 1,283, 85 level, and it extends up to about 1,290. So what I'm kind of watching for, Jordan, particularly ahead of this Brexit vote, you know, the Great Britain possibly voting to leave the European Monetary Union, I'm kind of waiting to see, can gold push through and actually close above the 1290 level? You know, we again, kind of like silver did with 1750. We haven't had a good close up here. You know, in silver, it's been, you know, I'd say over a month. Well, in gold, we haven't had a really good close up here above that 1285 level. You got to go all the way back really to, you know, like in middle of May, actually almost the first week of May to find it. So A close above 1285, particularly if it was able to close above 1290, to me would be highly significant on that price chart because it would show you that the sellers that were there before that were really aggressively selling, they've been beaten back. Now, where they're going to make their next stand is anybody's guess. I mean, you can look at the chart and you can get some indications, but my guess is if they get beaten back at the 1290 level, then they're going to retreat to 1300. So I think you might have a very good possibility here that where you could see handle switch and you could get a 13 print. And then we're all going to wait to see what happens with that Brexit vote because, you know, that has the potential to unleash a lot more chaos in these markets. And depending on how that thing goes, you know, you could see gold pop through 1300 pretty easily. So we'll just have to wait and see how that event goes. We don't know for sure, but from a technical perspective, you know, gold, like I said, 1285, 1290, if it closes up through there, that's going to be pretty impressive. So anyhow, going back to your other thing, TraderDan.com, they're interested in finding me, so they can come over there. We'll look at the dollar. We look at a lot of the other things like the bond markets as well because those are important. We look at the yield curve and things that might impact these market movements, and hopefully we can make some sense out of where prices are going because, quite honestly, these are some of the most difficult trading conditions I've faced in my entire career because there's so much uncertainty. Nobody really knows for sure how this is going to end or what to do next or where prices are going to go next or what some currency is going to do the next day or what some central bank statement is going to be, whether the Bank of Japan is going to make a comment or the ECB or the Fed. I mean, everything is so sensitive right now. One guy can come out and make a comment and all hell gets unleashed. And then the next day somebody can come out and it's like it never happened. So it's very, very volatile trading environment. And that uncertainty leads to big price swings, which oftentimes makes it kind of difficult to predict what we're going to get from day to day.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Dan, before I let you go one more time, give out the website.
Yeah, TraderDan.com.
All righty, Dan. Well, thanks so much for coming on today. I and my listeners really appreciate it. And we'll have to speak again maybe after the Brexit vote to, you know, recap what happens after that madness.
Oh, absolutely, Jordan. I would welcome that. That would be a lot of fun to see what happens. I mean, we're all going to get an education. There's no doubt about that. We're all going to see what's going to happen there. And And then, you know what, the thing about these markets, well, we'll get through Brexit, and then we'll all be talking about, gee, what's the July payrolls number going to be? And then that'll be the next event. So it never ends. There's never a dull moment in the markets, that's for sure.